Off the ball on News Talk. Thanks to Air. Catch all the sports you love free on the Air Sport Pack with Air Broadband.
Raphael Honigstein will talk to us about Carlo Ancelotti at Bayern Munich and Nagelsmann looming in the background. 30-year-old Nagelsmann waiting to swoop and take Ancelotti's job. Ancelotti, it seems, quite happy to give him the job eventually and get his payoff. So Raphael Honigstein will talk to us about that. We'll have Pat Nevin with us very shortly. And before we go any further, Kylian Mbappe, Kev.
Yeah.
We're all guilty of copying our heroes or idols growing up and being influenced by them. Kylian Mbappe, his idol growing up was Zinedine Zidane. Mbappe did an interview this week talking about his love for Zidane, including copying his haircut. At the time, he says, I didn't understand what boldness was. So I went to the hairdresser, because when you love a player, you want to do everything like him. And I didn't know what boldness was. And I told the hairdresser to cut and shave a bit of my hair from the top, like I was going bald. The hairdresser said, what? And he said, you heard me. And so Kylian Mbappe, as a kid, had the crown of his head shaved to look like Zinedine Zidane.
It is total class.
He also heard growing up that Zinedine Zidane loves spinach. He said, when you love a player, you want to do everything like him. If he eats spinach, a kid's going to eat spinach, even if he didn't like it. Here we go. Kylian Mbappe.
He's got the thing is with him as well, he's got the skill of Zidane. Wow. That's the thing, he's got the skill of Zidane and the pace of Henri. So that's maybe a frightening thought going
that's
forward.
That's a scary combination. Pat Nevin is on the line. Good evening, Pat.
How you doing, chaps?
So an interesting weekend on a host of fronts. Not least, you were at Stamford Bridge for Chelsea-Arsenal, which finished nil-all. A ground where Arsenal have gone so many times and been picked off and looked incredibly naive. And things obviously aren't amazing at Arsenal at the moment. And I think we were all kind of fully expecting an Arsenal come out and play and get picked off in a 2-3-4-0 job and Wenger in crisis. Instead, it seems, neither Kevin nor I saw the game in full, but it seems like this was a very organised Arsenal performance.
It was a really interesting technical game. And you always say that about 0-0s, don't you? Well, definitely the case this time. Chelsea had the first of it, first 15 minutes, Chelsea controlled it. But then they realised that Arsenal kind of had the measure of them. They stayed really strict to that the system they had. They were getting some good movement on Monreal getting forward from there. And by the end of the first half, Wenger's tactics had worked and had really adapted it so that his team were on top. Second half, Conte then adapted it a little bit, puts Fabregas forward, brings on Bakayoko. And then Chelsea had the... Sorry, that was my phone in the background there. Not a good thing to happen.
All right.
What happened then?
Wow.
There we go. That's the first, isn't it?
Well, thanks for nothing, Pat Nevin.
Yeah.
Couldn't have gone worse. It was a weekend. We brought both of those games live yesterday. Chelsea and Arsenal, nil all.
Yeah.
And Manchester United 4, Everton 0. And the other standout result was Watford 0, Manchester City 6.
Here's Ramsey, beats one player, beats a second, Aaron Ramsey! Oh, he's hit the inside of the post, and oh my goodness, Lacazette has put the rebound over the bar. Wonderful run from Aaron Ramsey. Oh, crunching tackle down here. Luis on Kolasinac, and Kolasinac is in all sorts of trouble. And Luis sees red, David Luis is sent off. He's complaining about an earlier incident.
How many times have we seen this with David Luiz? He gets the ball, does something tricky, knows that the man's coming down to close him down, gets his arm up, looking to throw that elbow. We've seen it so many times before, and then totally goes over the ball and Koscielny.
Matic curls into the box. Here's a shot. Oh, what a goal! Oh, that's amazing from Antonio Valencia. First time up at waist height. He has smashed the ball into the top corner of the Stretford end. It's Manchester United 1, Everton 0. Matic with the rebound puts it in there. Here comes to Lukaku, and he does score against his former club. And he cups a hand behind his ear as well as he runs away towards the Everton fans. I'm not sure that's necessary. Romelu Lukaku does the business, though, against his former team.
Walker finds Aguero, though, nipping it around the core. And it's in again for Jesus. It's 3. Sensational, scintillating, attacking football. Pep Guardiola's men on this kind of form will take some stopping. Aguero just trying to tiptoe his way through. Was it in? Sergio Aguero turns to celebrate a hat-trick. Back in May, they put 5 past Watford, and it was the Hornets' biggest home defeat since 1951. 4 months later, they're back,
and the win is even more emphatic. It's Watford 0, Manchester City 6.
Pat Nevin, you're back with us.
I certainly am. Sorry, but I'm having slight nightmares of technology at the moment. I have an ISDN line over here in the UK. For 4 weeks, BT have been telling me it's working. It's not. And then my Skype goes down, and I'm thinking, what is going on here? And I don't know if you get the same problem there, but Hotmail's died today.
Yes.
Hotmail is out.
Yeah, I've heard that, yeah.
And I'm in, yeah. We're Gmail men mainly over here, Pat.
Yeah, well, we've already had BT being slaughtered by Cammy earlier on, and Jeff, didn't we? So now that's twice now BT are taking a bit of a slagging tonight.
Oh, hammered. Anyway, I just caught the end of what you listening to the Man City stuff. And I was at that game as well. I had a pretty busy weekend.
Mm. Well, we'll come back to City. I knew you were at that game and definitely want to hear about just how good they were. But you were we just lost you as you were talking Chelsea-Arsenal, and you were saying first 15 minutes Chelsea, and then Arsenal felt they got to grips with them and realised they were very comfortable enough in this game?
Yeah, they were. And I would say they were actually beginning to dominate. It goes far as that. And at half-time, certainly Arsenal deserved to be in the lead more than Chelsea would have been. But the adaptations that Conte made, and it's a quite simple one, he brings back Yoko on to stay beside Kante, moves Fabregas up, quite in a defensive-ish kind of move.
Mm.
But it made it very, very sensible for Chelsea. But then it really became a stalemate, as much as anything after that. The two late introductions of Hazard and Sanchez didn't have the desired effect. You'd like them to have been on from the start, but it really was stalemate. And it was odd, though, because so many times in the past I've watched Arsene Wenger try things, or more often than not, fail to try things at Chelsea. This time he was on his game, he was on his mettle, and I actually think Arsene Wenger did well. His team did well as well, but tactically he got it right, and he's got it so wrong before at Chelsea. So, yeah, certainly tick marks for Arsenal, and they'll definitely be the happier team.
I just caught the highlights, and that's obviously not a complete picture of the game, but what was very striking, and I don't think I've ever seen it before on the heat map, is that essentially on the heat map post-game, Arsenal looked as they would on the formation sheet that you get on your screen before kickoff. It was uncanny. They were all exactly in their positions, which you don't usually see, and I presumed ultimately that was a good thing. Maybe it means the team are a bit stagnant, I don't know, but I presume it's a good thing, and they're well organised. And then the match of the day coverage certainly focused as well on Ramsey and Xhaka and their positional play, and they circled the two players and had a line between them and showed how they moved in unison. And the general conclusion was that Arsenal had actually worked on this stuff during the week.
And that is an almost perfect description of the antithesis of Barcelona, which is exactly the way that Arsene Wenger would have always liked to have played. So he's thrown in the cell, hasn't he, to some degree, of what he wanted to do, this open kind of football, this total football, where there's movement and ability all around the place for everyone to play in any position. No, not this time. He needed a result. He needed some sort of performance. And that's exactly what he did. You're absolutely right. I don't think, sometimes those heat maps can tell a little bit of a lie, but you're absolutely right. They were right this time. And there was no space, no real space for, you know, Chelsea to run into. They knew they had a left wing back, Kolasinac. He actually did really well, you know, after a troublesome first 15 minutes against Moses. But every single little thing you thought would be changed and adapted by Chelsea's players, no, they had an answer for them. And really, for someone to do something very different, it needed a manager to take a chance. Actually, neither manager looked as if they wanted to take too many chances in this. So I sound a little bit down about this game, and it was intriguing. But having been at Manchester City the day before, it just made you think, oh dear, there's a gulf.
Yeah, I mean, Joel, I think Joel wants to get to that point, but I just more in relation to Arsenal, I think that's the story from this game, with how often, and Joel's touched on it before, how often they've been to Chelsea and Man United, Man City, Liverpool, wherever it's been, and they've just looked to play so open. So you've touched on it there, the system, but I just want to talk to you about a couple of the personnel that's within that. Mustafi back in there, Pat. He hadn't been playing Mustafi this season, and he was probably Arsenal's best defender last season. Alex Iwobi played midweek in the Europa League game. He played as a holding midfielder. Didn't think it suited him at all. He's played there. Obviously, him playing a bit further forward. So, in relation to the two holding midfielders, Ramsey and Xhaka and Mustafi coming in, particularly that trio, from what's in, of course I didn't see it, but it's almost if they play with a bit more of a disciplined role, particularly Ramsey and Xhaka as protective.
Yeah, no, that's what they tried to do. I mean, In general, if you play with three at the back and you tell them not to move much, and then you get the two centre midfielders to at least have one of them be disciplined, and at all times one of them was disciplined, and that made a difference. I mentioned the practice, if you're three centre backs, you know, one of the two are disciplined, and both wing backs, you know, Kolasinac, he's, you know, he just can run and he's a power and he's hard to get by. Monreal on the other side, like, he's got monumentally good pace. One of the few people I've seen outrun Alonso throughout a game. So as a fact, you know, it was a bit the least complicated you could ever see an Arsenal team. But you're right, they asked him just to do the simple thing. I thought Iwobi was unbelievably quiet. I mean, he just did a job.
Yeah.
We've all been there before. You want to be involved, you want to be in central, you want to be the playmaker, and then your manager shouts, there's your job. Stay disciplined and don't move. It's horrible, but sometimes you need to, you know, do it for the team. And I think it will be done a little bit of that. I don't think there was a lot of creativity or anything else from him. And it maybe stood out that little bit more, because if Iwobi wasn't playing, it would have been Sanchez. And 99.9% of the people in that ground wanted to see Sanchez on the pitch. So it's a wee bit, it's not Iwobi's fault, but you know, he wasn't having a fantastic effect on the game. But only in a kind of negative sense, they stopped Chelsea playing. And that was the whole deal. That's what they were doing now. That's what they were trying to do.
David Luiz picked up a very deserved red card. But before that, he was yellow carded for an overhead kick where he caught Koscielny on the chest. And given all the talk about Mane, why is an overhead kick which goes into an opponent's chest or certainly head, that has to now be a red card in the context of Mane?
If that's the case, then the overhead kick should be banned from football.
I put it to you. It should.
It can't be banned. That cannot be banned, because if you're not endangering a player, if you're not near anyone,
how do you know? Your back to the player.
Yeah, a player wouldn't know that necessarily himself, but you can't take that instinctive play away from a player where he's just going to actually just not go for an overhead kick.
I'm being facetious here.
Oh, I know. Joel wants that, I think. Joel wants it banned.
Ian Wright very seriously last night said it should be banned.
No, I don't want it banned. I felt really sorry for David Luiz getting booked for that one, because, you know, it's kind of a South American, Brazilian thing. They all learn how to do overhead kicks. See them practicing on the beaches and things like that. It's a really common thing. you take a chance, you know, that. And I think, you know, if it's a wild one where there's a whole bunch of players around, maybe you take a chance and think, well, I might get a yellow card.
Sorry to interrupt.
The Mane thing's different.
Yeah, okay. The Mane thing I accept is slightly different. But Wayne Rooney's overhead kick against Manchester City, he knew there was nobody near him. Fair enough. It's a beautiful thing. Yeah. It would be a tragedy if that was lost from the game. Yeah. But if you're in a crowded penalty box and a ball comes in and you go for the overhead kick and you catch an opponent, that has to be a red card, isn't it?
You cannot know. Wayne Rooney didn't know. Wayne Rooney thought there was nobody near him.
Yeah.
And how often have you seen it, though? How often have you seen that?
Generally, you don't see players try them in very crowded situations. Luiz certainly did. If you're in a box and a ball comes in and there's players around you and you try an overhead kick and you catch an opponent, that should be a red card at this stage.
No, but it can't be. You can't make a rule for one part of the pitch. It's not a rule in a different part.
The centre circle then. if there's people around and you catch someone, then it should be a red card, surely.
Exactly. So that means Rooney, if somebody happened to be in that area, he should have been carded and all that sort of thing. It's a shame. It's getting a bit of a grey area now. In times gone past, it would have been, his feet were high. He was always trying to get an overhead kick. There was too many people around. The referee would have stopped it and said, no, don't do that. Free kick against you, carry on. That's what would have been done in the past. But, you know, the game is changing, the way the game's refereed. By the way, the refereeing of the game in Chelsea-Arsenal was lost anyway for a good part of it, because he went into one of those phases, the referee, where if someone lands on the ground, it must be either a card or else a free kick. And sometimes people collide, but he didn't seem to get that. And it's a sadness, that, because oddly enough, I was talking before the game. Now, I know I'm talking to people who have got good, hard, robust sports all around you. I was talking to a couple of Aussie rules footballers before the game on the pitch at Stamford Bridge, and I asked them specifically, and they actually laughed out loud at the softness of football and the ridiculousness. And to be fair, that's where we've got, isn't it?
I know.
It really is where you've got. If you go and look at the Gaelic and the hurling and the rugby and you think footballs aren't allowed to try the odd overhead kick, we're in a sad place.
Smurfs right, though, Joe. Be spot on.
Manchester City 6, Watford 0, a hat-trick for Aguero. It was 4-3-3, it seemed, Pat. They went four at the back against Feyenoord midweek as well. They had De Bruyne, Silva, Fernandinho behind them. They had Sterling in for Bernardo Silva. And once again, they worked Aguero and Jesus into the team. Chris Kamara was on the show earlier. He was at that game and said it was about as good a Premier League performance as he's seen in a really long time.
Yeah, I'm up there. I would slightly disagree with the formation. I'd say the formation was more 2-5-3. It really was. It was ridiculous. It was mental. Mendy spent his whole time at left wing and Walker the other side spent his whole time at right wing. It was stunning. I mean, to be honest, excuse me, De Bruyne was okay. David Silva was okay. But the others were just off the scale. If you had them two playing at their best on top of that, it's just frightening. It was a joy to watch. I did not want that game to end. Half an hour gone, I think it was 1-0 at that point, and I think City got to the bylines with 9-10 times, with ease, the way they were passing around. There's a million things you can say about City, and I've been thinking long and hard about it over the weekend, and here's the best thing, I think. You've got that team now playing kind of the way that Pep's wanted them to do it, right? Playing from the back, even in tight situations. Look, it doesn't matter, we'll lose it now and again. But they've got it now. Every one of them buying into it now. They're playing not dissimilar to the way Barcelona are the best of them. Not saying they're as good as them, but that's the way they're trying to play just now. Better than all of that, he gets good players, and he gets really good players, and he begins to make them great. That's unusual. I think that's really unusual. The amount of managers, you buy a really good player, and you think, oh, he's a great player, let him play. Not good enough for Pep.
Mm.
He's got De Bruyne. He's made him a great player. He really has. I didn't know it was the case, but I think I've changed my mind on Saturday because he did that with De Bruyne. He's got Aguero. Aguero's now a far better footballer, a far all-rounded footballer. And you thought he was going to push him out because he was more selfish in the past. Now he's not. But the absolute giveaway is Sterling. Sterling was a head down, almost a Theo Walcott, great vision about him. I watched him Saturday. I swear to God, he was playing like Messi. Everything was angles. He was looking up at everything that was around him. Touch was great. His pace was fantastic. But he's a footballer now. He's got awareness now. That just didn't happen. Wow. That just wasn't a fluke. I'm the slowest person that you'll ever meet to say that about players like that. Because the one thing that drives me mad about speedy wingers is because I don't think they're all footballers. They're just runners. He turned that into a footballer. And an unbelievably good one. I'm stunned by them. I thought they were phenomenal. And I think Pep, he's close to something extraordinary already with him.
Wow, that's really interesting.
We've not got much time here, Pat. We're just looking at Gabriel Jesus now has got the best minutes per goal ratio in Premier League history for a goal scorer of 10 and above, which, you know, the impact that he's made. But just on those two, Aguero and Jesus, getting those two into the side. We enjoyed a conversation last week. We're talking about City playing three to get those two into the side, or a four. It's almost as if when they play with the four, I think City, certainly from the full-back's perspective, and you said they're with the five, they look so much better. So, first of all, I mean, maybe the one point, I suppose, on it, Pat, is can City maintain what they weren't able to maintain last season?
They can against the average to decent teams, without even a shadow of a doubt. I mean, that's 6-0 away from home against Watford, and it should have been 12. Right, so that's they're miles ahead. The question comes when you come away clever people. I mean, Jose Mourinho won't let that happen to his team. So you know that's going to be more difficult. It's not going to be allowed to happen at the latter stages of the Champions League. So that's when the real tests come, if they are capable. For all my positive words, I still think it's a year early. I think by next year they'll probably have it right, and I wouldn't be betting against anything against his team, because he won't just keep them together. He'll actually make them better and make them stronger and make them more skillful and make them believe in it more. And the technical things that he's doing a little bit now, I mean, we see managers doing this once or twice. You know, we're talking about two centre-backs, they're playing two at the back. But of course, Fernandinho knows when to come back into that to make it a three and make it a triangle. And so now and again during the game, Stones would just walk in and he'd be the point of the triangle of that. They're really comfortable. It's not exactly the same, but we used to read about and watch Total Football with a touch in 74. It's the concept. It's just that. It's that concept, but taken to a different level just now, and able to do it in good pitches. Honestly, the world's at their feet. I'm going to tell you a really strange thing. For all my waxing lyrical, for all loving it, I've still not changed my mind. I still think United will win the league. They're not the best team, but they know how to win. And something will let Pep down this time, won't it? They'll overdo it one day, and that's the thing that Jose's team will be in around their necks waiting for. But by next year, I think they'll be so far ahead, it'll be incredible. I think they were brilliant. They really were brilliant.
Pat, beautifully done. We'll talk next week. Pat. Thanks.
All right, see ya.
Jerry on the M50. Not happy with Pat Nevin. Put Morata in my fantasy league team instead of Aguero after Pat Nevin raved about him last week. Thanks a bunch. That's a painful one.
Yeah, I've got Morata in mine as well, so I'm struggling, really.
Hat-trick for Aguero, Morata, yeah. Nothing. That's very interesting what he was saying about Raheem Sterling becoming a footballer.
Yeah.
Quotes, a footballer, because it seemed to me and to a lot of people that he was in the Theo Walcott camp of that speedy winger that doesn't have much of a brain for it. And the consensus on those type of players is it's very hard to actually give them football intelligence. Like Walcott's improved but never quite become a footballer. If he turns Sterling into a really intelligent footballer with all the natural gifts, then you're talking about an unbelievable job.
Yeah, positional sense. It's funny, he touched on something there brilliantly, I thought, as well, was how many times do clubs go and sign players, pay big money for players, and it's right, that's it now. You don't need to be coached anymore. Raheem Sterling's a young man. He's still got a hell of a lot to learn. So he essentially is that sort of player that needs coaching more than anybody.
Yeah.
And sometimes you see them rot away because they're just not coached. They're literally told, right, that's it now. We'll do training sessions. We'll do not so much coaching sessions. And they need to be coached. They need to learn the game as they're getting older. And I think he's certainly a player that's got to be, well, you know, watched on the training ground, coerced into position, telling him where to stand. He's that sort of player that needs that more than ever.
Hands on.
Yeah.
And Guardiola is that. And it seems Carlo Ancelotti is the opposite of that. And Bayern Munich are learning that at the moment. And it seems their players aren't terribly happy about the situation. Apologies for this. We ran over with the GA, so we have to squeeze in another ad break. But then we'll have about 15, 16, 17 minutes with Raphael Honigstein, who's got some interesting things to tell us about Carlo Ancelotti at Bayern Munich at the moment. So interesting times at Bayern Munich. Carlo Ancelotti is a year and a few months into his three-year deal. Last year, there was a Bundesliga win and Real Madrid knocked him out of the Champions League. And it just seems that there are misgivings about the job he's doing at the moment. Lothar Matthäus came out strongly and said that there was chaos at the club and that Ancelotti needed to be much tougher with the players and be more hands-on, and said he needs to get a grip of things very, very quickly. They're currently third in the Bundesliga after four games. They did win 4-0 at the weekend, it should be said, so it's not as if they're completely stinking out the joint. But Carlo Ancelotti, with Julian Nagelsmann looming in the background, is under a lot of pressure to the point where he's been asked about his future constantly. Here's what he had to say about his desire to stay on as manager.
I want to say that I am happy to be here. I am happy to stay here until the end of my contract, and after that I hope that we can continue here, and after that if I'm not here I have to find another solution, and I was in England 2 years and I had a good experience and a good memory of this period. But I also can say I was in France and I had a good experience, a good memory, and I was in Spain and I had a good experience and a good memory. And also I was also in Italian, and Italy is my country. So to talk about, I never been in China, just for a few days this summer. So you never know in the future what happened, and really I don't know in the which will be my future. Really in this moment I'm not worried about this. The only thing is that I want to continue to do my job for a long time. Not time to stop.
So Raphael Honigstein joins us. It hasn't been the best of starts to this season for Ancelotti. At one point, Bayern were sixth in the Bundesliga after the first three games. They beat Mainz 4-0 at the weekend. We'll get on to the Nagelsmann situation, which is obviously a key part of this, in a second. But just talk to us firstly about the early season wobbles at Bayern.
Well, I mean, for Bayern, early season wobbles translate into one game lost. You know, it's all relative. A crisis for them is not being top of the Bundesliga. A crisis is for them having a bad night that still ends in a 3-0 win in the Champions League. after which a lot of the criticism that you saw from Lothar Matthäus and that kind of feeling of a loss of discipline inside the dressing room became a real topic. So most clubs would love to have that kind of problem. For Bayern, I think there is a sense that Ancelotti's time in Munich has not really resulted in the team perhaps utilizing the maximum of their potential. He is a manager in the real sense of the word. He manages this team. Does he develop them? Does he really coach them? Does he take them anywhere near the sort of levels of football that we've seen under Guardiola? No. To a certain extent, Bayern knew that before. But they were still, I think, taken aback a little bit by just how hands-off and laissez-faire his regime has been. As long as everybody's winning, that's not an issue. But as soon as the first result goes against them, that's when the fault lines become a hot topic, and that's when the sort of the veneer of harmony starts chipping away.
We've seen certain things from certain players. Thomas Müller scored at the weekend, but he spent some time on the bench and he said, "I don't know exactly which qualities the coach wants to see, but mine seem not to be 100% in demand." We've seen Lewandowski talk about the lack of action in the transfer window and maybe also the lack of assists as he tries to win another golden boot last season. He wasn't overly happy with the amount of assists. We've seen Ribéry throw his jersey at the ground. So these rumblings are going on certainly and publicly as well at times. Reading into what you're saying, it does seem to be a group who got very used to the obsessive attention to detail of Guardiola, now not quite enjoying the kind of more old school Ancelotti approach. Is that a big part of this issue?
No, I think they're enjoying the approach. It's a little bit like the school teacher that doesn't give you a lot of homework. I mean, you enjoy that kind of teacher, but you don't necessarily think that he's really helping you when it comes to the exams at the end of the season.
Yeah.
So I think you have to separate these things. I mean, nobody really says we don't like what Ancelotti is doing. We don't like him as a person. Certainly inside the club and inside the dressing room, there are those who feel that perhaps they should be doing something a little bit different, working a little bit harder. But the bigger issue, I think, is one of authority. Because Ancelotti doesn't enjoy the full backing of the club the way Guardiola did, even with all the problems that he had, and because there is this uncertainty about his future beyond the season, and because in Bayern, at the board level themselves, there is a bit of a conflict between Karl-Heinz Rummenigge, the CEO, and Uli Hoeneß, the president, who's come back and trying to wrest control back from Rummenigge. What you see from the players is they are saying things perhaps that they would have been afraid to say under different managers, and when the board were more unified. And the amazing thing I think that's happened this weekend is I think the players, at least some of them themselves, realized that if we continue to do this, we will not have success. So they had a clear of the air meeting. They got together and they decided to try to be more of a team. And you could see this in the body language on Saturday when they beat Mainz 4-0. You could see Robin and Ribéry, who's never really been the best of friends, exchanging a kiss when Robin came off and Ribéry came on. So the team, I think, are trying almost to fill the vacuum that existed before and saying we have to now get closer together because otherwise this thing is falling apart. And maybe the stuff we talked about earlier, you know, has just been a useful warning shot and a sign for everybody that we cannot continue because otherwise really we'll have huge problems this season.
Rafa, you just mentioned Rummenigge there and the board. What are the issues between Ancelotti and the board then? Is there anything that's clear that's come out? Because I've been reading stuff around the FC Hollywood is back, where in relation to the German press putting stuff on the front pages of newspapers recently. So are there issues then with the board and Ancelotti then? Do you see anything with that?
There is nothing at a personal level. Right. It's all about the football. It's all about his way of coaching. They knew that he was pretty hands off. They knew that he was easy to, you know, to get along with. And in a way, that's what they wanted after 3 years of high maintenance of under Guardiola. At the same time, they put heavy pressure on him in the off season to get a firm commitment from him to put Joshua Kimmich in the starting 11 as a right back. They got, I think, some sort of commitment from him to look more after young players like Kingsley Coman, you know, these kind of guys who are there to inherit the positions of the more established players. And they did two things that perhaps most coaches would have resisted, but because he's so easy to get along, he didn't, which is they put a sporting director in Hasan Salihamidžić just next to him on the bench, who's almost like a watchdog, reports to the board and has a go at players if they're late to training or one of the massagists having a smoke in the dressing room. You know, he is now the man that enforces it because Ancelotti didn't. And they took in Vili Saniola, another former Bayern player, to be his assistant coach because he didn't appoint anyone when Clement left to Swansea. And they were very disappointed by that because they thought, you know, he's going to give him a name. And instead he promoted his own son. And that was the sort of thing that really didn't go down too well with the board. But it's nothing on a personal level. It's just that they feel he's perhaps not doing his job quite well enough.
This sounds like Ancelotti taking his nonchalance to parody levels. I mean, like just a puff of the cheeks and he'll raise his eyebrow and say, well, look, if it works out, it works out. If it doesn't, I will go off to China or wherever the next big paycheck is. I mean, not many managers would indulge the notion, especially as experienced as Ancelotti, of, well, you're going to have a sporting director sit on the bench beside me and report back to the board.
Yeah, but Ancelotti is completely resistant to pressure and in a way that scares Bayern because he's done it all. I mean, he's worked under all sorts of regimes at all the biggest and craziest clubs, if you want, in the world. Yeah. And he no longer is fazed by the idea of getting fired and enjoying a few months off with a big paycheck. He just does not care. Mm. I mean, Didi Hamann the other day on German television said that he comes across like a man who actually doesn't mind being sacked and is looking forward to another prolonged holiday in Canada going fishing. And I probably wouldn't put it as strongly as that, but certainly a guy who is pretty impervious to sort of the normal mechanisms of European top club football is a bit scary for the board. And there's not really much they can do about it. In a way, I think they respect it. And as long as they have a realistic shot at winning the Champions League and are winning the Bundesliga, nobody really cares too much. Mm. It's just when results go wrong or when they get knocked out a little bit too early in the Champions League, that's when these things come back. Because you can do whatever you want as a coach as long as you're winning. But the first thing they'll do, they ask if you're working hard enough if you're not.
Mm. Joel touched on something earlier on where he mentioned about the obsessiveness of Guardiola. And there was rumours then around Guardiola and how his obsessiveness was probably something that they wanted to get away from, as you say there, by bringing Ancelotti. But would it be fair then to say that they've gone, obviously, with the total extreme then from Guardiola in that, and they haven't necessarily got that happy medium in there then?
I think that is a fair summary. I mean, they knew that Ancelotti is a very different type of manager, that he's a man manager. They wanted all that. They wanted somebody who is much more amenable, not as difficult to have a conversation with. I mean, when they wanted to talk to Guardiola, they had to go through one of his assistants because Guardiola wasn't really amenable to having these face-to-face discussions about things. And after a while, Bayern got very unnerved by that and felt that's not really the way to do things. And of course, he fell out with a lot of people there behind the scenes, Guardiola. The players responded to him, but even they at times found it very hard going. One of them told me that he came off after every single training session with a headache. Mm. But at the same time, he appreciated it because he felt that he was being challenged and being developed as a player. Now with Ancelotti, when you see the training, when you see the kind of lack of intensity that really exists, the team is much more responsible for themselves to keep their house in order. And it's sort of almost like a more nostalgic setup, if you want, where you have, of course, a manager, but the leadership comes from the dressing room, from the guys who push the younger guys, who make sure that they're on time, not wearing any silly stuff. I mean, it's kind of sort of back to that thing. And while Bayern has enough players to do that, at the same time, they want consistency. They don't want a coach that sees, you know, somebody misses training or is late and doesn't react, because then they themselves feel, you know, I'm professional here. Mm. Others are getting away with it. This is not really how things should be done at this level.
Which brings us to Julian Nagelsmann, the Hoffenheim coach. A lot of people would have read that. It was an excellent piece in The Guardian about Nagelsmann when they played Liverpool in the Champions League qualifier about a month or so ago. And he is of the Guardiola ilk. He is obsessive. He's a young man. He's 30 years old, 29 years old. He is innovative. There are all sorts of, you know, like lots of stories about the intensity of his training sessions. He has a giant television screen in the middle of the training pitch where he can stop play at any point and play back the training match to players on the big screen and go through everything in fine detail. He is meticulous, and they obviously beat Bayern a couple of weeks ago, Hoffenheim, and it was seen as, well, the young man essentially auditioning in front of the Bayern board. So Nagelsmann himself came out with a quote in the last week or so, which he apologised for, obviously, but he said, you know, FC Bayern plays a big role in my dreams. I lived in Munich for many years. It's my home. My wife and my kid will move to Munich soon. We're building a house there. He apologised to Ancelotti for how that would obviously be interpreted. So talk to us about Nagelsmann and how desperate or otherwise Bayern are to lock this guy down before somebody else swoops.
Well, Nagelsmann, I think, is increasingly be seen as once-in-a-lifetime generational coaching talent in Germany. Tuchel, I think, probably was even more highly rated, but he's burnt his bridges at Dortmund to an extent where I think his next station has to be outside the Bundesliga, and he will almost sort of has to rehabilitate himself, not when it comes to the coaching, but the way he deals with players and boards and even journalists to a certain extent. Nagelsmann has done something quite spectacular, because not only has he taken Hoffenheim from the brink of relegation into the Champions League in the space of 14 months, but he's been able to transport or communicate or get across this kind of tactical innovation and all these ideas while still emotionally connecting with a team that was very, very hard to manage. Because if you imagine Hoffenheim, a very small club with considerable money, but everybody really goes there in order to go somewhere else. It's just a stepping stone. And, you know, it doesn't always attract the right kind of professionals, because if you want to go to Hoffenheim, really go there because the money's good, or, you know, you have a view to going somewhere else afterwards. But to be in control of such a dressing room at such a young age and getting them to really buy into your methods, I think shows that he could be one of those rare talents who have both. So the tactical know-how and the ideas, but also what is crucial in football is the ability to bond with players and to create a unity and to create a kind of togetherness that without, it's very hard to get anywhere. And I think Bayern are to an extent afraid that if they don't appoint him fairly soon, he could go to another club, to a Dortmund, for example, who wanted him in the summer or abroad, and that they will miss out on the best German manager, just as they did with Jurgen Klopp. They appointed Jurgen Klinsmann in the year where they could have had Jurgen Klopp, and they basically lived to regret it. So I'd be surprised if there hadn't been some kind of informal, at least, understanding that if and when Ancelotti's position becomes available, that Nagelsmann will be, they probably haven't promised him the job just yet, but I'd be pretty confident in saying that there is a kind of understanding that he will be the first guy person they talk to.
Wow. All very interesting. Rafa, thanks very much.
Pleasure.
Thanks, Rafa.
That's Rafa Hangstein. Really interesting stuff there. Ben Ancelotti at Bayern. Mm. That's us pretty much done for this evening, Kev. You can go off and lick your wounds over the next 24 hours. Highlights tomorrow will include Cora Staunton on the show. There's always that.
Yeah, yeah. Good. We'll look forward to next Sunday.
Yeah. So we'll see you tomorrow. Usual time. Tom Dunn is on the way next.